Welcome to Saving the Game. This is Episode 10, Gaming as a Church Activity, recorded Thursday, November 15th of 2012, with your hosts, Grant, Peter, Brandon, and Shannon. Welcome to Saving the Game. I'm Grant.
I'm Peter.
I'm Brandon.
I'm Shannon.
And joining us tonight, we have Shannon, who's a friend of all of ours through the Fear the Boot community, member of the Fear the Boot Writers Guild, and generally awesome person. Hello, Shannon.
Hello.
How's it going?
Very good.
Good. Glad to hear it. So we've got Shannon on tonight because she does gaming at her church as a church activity for a number of kids. Am I getting that right?
Kids and everybody.
This topic actually just got a little more interesting.
Yeah, okay. Now I'm curious about that.
Yeah.
Well, this gets down to why the way Deep River is. Our town has this deep-seated fear of being bored. Nobody wants to be bored. Everybody's first question is, are you happy? Are you fed? Do you have enough to do? Well, a couple summers ago, it looked like we were going to have a cold, wet summer. And so we said, well, let's just have Sunday night. We'll open up the church basement where it'll be nice and warm. And we can go down there. We can play games. Everybody can come. We'll just bring armfuls of board games in and we'll all have fun. And we did that all that summer, and it was for all ages. And then it happened several other summers, and then it started to happen once or twice a month on a regular basis. So we have family board game nights and tabletop role-playing and all manner of games nights and people hanging over each other's shoulders, kibitzing and not actually playing, but being there nights. So it's all ages, everything from sitting around playing chess and the sort of card games that a pre-literate child can read, up to everything. We haven't played Risk yet because it takes too long. But
yeah.
Yeah, a Risk game can last for weeks.
Yeah, it really can. Have you tried Risk Legacy?
No, I haven't. I'm not fond enough of Risk to bother. I believe one of our young people who is currently away at university has done it.
Okay. Well, that's fair. I was just curious because it seemed like the sort of thing that if you had the time for a Risk game could be fun since you have people who all meet together semi-regularly.
It would.
So I had one question that's kind of been intriguing me since we started asking Shannon about coming on this episode. Did you run into any kind of resistance from your church about running tabletop role-playing games there? Because I know at least here in the United States, listeners, for those of you who are unaware, which is probably most of you, Shannon lives in Canada. Is there less of a stigma attached to tabletop RPGs, or did you personally overcome that somehow? Or
two ways we got around it. We more got around it. Yes, the stigma is a little bit more diffuse. Because I'm an Anglican, well, I'm currently being an Anglican, saying that that a church is Anglican doesn't really tell you very much about it because it can mean anything from jumping up and down Pentecostal to sitting in a corner or glaring at other people because they're not conservative enough for you. This is a small-town Anglican, which means all brands of that have to get along together, so we tend not to jump up and down on soapboxes about very much, which is good. However, I know that there are some people in the church who are uncomfortable, two big words, magic and dragons. So the kind of role-playing that we introduced, although some of the games we have brought, like Munchkin and the others, mention magic in passing, the role-playing that we do, in fact, is more like steampunk. So I know that there are several people who regularly come to the game nights who, in fact, do have an aversion to games with magic and dragons, so we just don't do those.
Fair enough.
The magic and dragons do show up in the Munchkin games, but as well as the other slightly, you know, slightly risque drawings and jokes. But I've noticed that they either simply go over the kid's head or they can take them in their stride, but mostly go straight over their head.
Well, Munchkin is, if anything, Munchkin is not a game to be taken seriously.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a real pity because I've only played it with people who take it seriously.
Oh, and if you're Munchkin seriously, you're playing it wrong. Yeah.
Yeah, oh, well, yeah. It's not so much playing it wrong as, oh, he plays to win. I see.
That's amusing.
So basically, what I'm hearing you describe is basically a lot of how I was raised with, so long as it's, you know, like, I got my start in role-playing in Star Wars because I was told that Dungeons & Dragons was evil and it would lead me to worshiping the devil. When I got Star Wars, I'm like, oh, this is something else. This is something different, and it's not that evil thing, because even I believed it. The first time I heard someone play Dungeons & Dragons, I was like, oh no, and I was scared of them. So basically by taking out all of the bad things that people object to, you've opened them up to all the good of, you know, being able to step into a role and learn all the moral lessons of role-playing games.
Yes, and to have all the fun. And I must say that there are other people in our church who would be quite happy playing the kind of fantasy role-playing game that I prefer and am much better at. That's the other real reason I would so much rather be doing the fantasy version than steampunk. I'm not very good at steampunk. I love it, but I'm not very good at it. We ought to be running it with Savage Worlds or something sensible like that. I'm not good at Savage Worlds yet. I like systems, but I take a long time to learn them. So what we're doing is using what I call a four-stat alternative, which is using tiny bits taken out of the Dungeons & Dragons books, basically bits of the player's manual, and there's one page that describes how to use guns. And so we're really not using a sensible system for the game, which I would be able to do if we were doing fantasy, but we're doing steampunk.
Out of sheer geeky curiosity, which edition of D&D are you using rules from?
I have standardized it all to using from third edition, but I just got the player's manual for second edition, and I've got the little old red book, so I can play second edition if I can ever figure it out.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, second edition was supposed to be the most impenetrable version of the game, I think. It has a reputation that way, anyway.
Depending on how much extra complexity you add in. Because there's a bunch of other books for it and that sort of thing.
I do find it not that impenetrable at all. I find the upside-down armor class thing weird, but I can live with it. It's just a set of charts.
Yep. By the way, this is a tangent, but is really cool. Apparently Wizards of the Coast is, in May of 2013, starting to do reprints of the second edition books.
Oh, good.
And shockingly, they're going to start producing a little bit of new material for AD&D.
Good.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, they're planning to... I think they actually already have reprinted the third edition core books, too.
Not third. They have first edition. You can order first edition reprints.
That's so exciting.
I may be wrong about third edition, but I know they have reprints of first edition.
Yeah, I think they were planning on reprinting, like, all of the previous editions and...
Yeah, I think so. I got a couple of guys who I'm going to get some of that for Christmas.
A couple times a week, when I meet another person who plays Dungeons & Dragons... Several times the last few people that I've met, they keep saying, you ask, what do you play? Oh, well, we like second edition. We just find it's more fun.
Yep.
And this is not, you know, old fogies like me. This is people you know, just out of high school, early college years.
Interesting. It's like the hipsters of D&D.
I can, by the
their
way,
little
Shannon,
fixie player's handbook.
If you would like, I collected a lot of steampunk material for third edition. So once we're done recording, I can give you like a list of stuff that I've got over here. And if you're looking for more resources to make that run a little more smoothly.
That would be good. I especially don't know enough about guns and stuff. I'm just not mechanically minded enough to do this.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah, Savage Worlds would be a good system. It's a little complicated, actually. There is a little bit of crunch to Savage Worlds. I'm trying to think of other good systems for steampunk. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any.
GURPS, but GURPS is like the most impenetrable, crunchy system in the world, if you aren't familiar with
There's a book for it, though, so, you know.
Oh, GURPS for Dummies?
Yes.
I think such a thing actually does exist, too, if
Probably.
I'm not mistaken.
Of course, there's D&D for Dummies, and I think Game Mastering for Dummies.
Yeah.
I don't think there's actually standards for the For Dummies series.
I wonder what the contents of the Game Mastering for Dummies book must be like. I do work in a bookstore. I should just order a copy in and take a look at it sometime.
Yeah.
See, I don't know if I would ever want to run in a game under someone who absolutely needs Game Mastering for Dummies.
Needs, no. Has on their shelf as an ironic birthday gift? Eh, okay.
Yes, but like is constantly referring to, okay, so apparently we're supposed to fight monsters now.
The Dummy series is actually pretty good. So I've read a number of books from there.
I actually have two of the Complete Idiot's Guides to Music Theory. They're actually really good.
And we have wandered way off of topic.
Just a little.
Yes, I was about to wondering, have we even said the verses yet?
No, we haven't.
No, we certainly haven't. So let's get those in real quick before we wander off any further. We just kind of dove straight into our topic this week. All right, so we've got three tonight, actually. We've got Proverbs 22:6. I guess I'll take that one.
You go ahead.
Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it.
Yep. And then our second one is Colossians 3:16-17. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. And whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him.
And then, Shannon, you suggested one, too. Do you want to go ahead and read that, or would you like one of us to?
I can read it. I've got the New King James open here. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works.
Okay. So, the original goal that I had for this discussion was talking about using role-playing games and games in general, really, with kids as a church activity, and how you use that to teach kids, teach them how to deal with situations, kind of expand their horizons a little bit, let them try out situations before they have to encounter them in real life. Dare we say, role-play them out. But it sounds like what you're doing is not even about that so much as just a church fellowship activity.
Well, and it bleeds over into the teaching the children thing, because the group that ended up most interested, it was open to everybody, but the ones who all immediately jumped into it was the 8 to 16-year-old boys, and there seems to be a strong whirlpool in my life where Shannon always ends up to the side of the room with all the 10-year-old boys. Why does this happen? I don't know. It happens again. And I'm also one of the Sunday school teachers for that age group. So yet again, it's Shannon off to the side. It's supposed to be the seniors and juniors, but because of pools of probability, almost all the girls are in the younger group, and there's this huge pile of 8 to 14-year-old boys in the seniors department. There is one girl in that age, and she decides to sit upstairs with her folks rather than sit with that many boys.
Well, see, this is actually a golden opportunity, because in another 6 years, you'll have a really good, experienced gaming group.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It is so good. It is very good. We're developing very much into good gamers. They're learning how to do it right. They're practicing. In some of their cases, they're also practicing their English, because Deep River is definitely a town where there's a lot of bilingualism. Not all of the kids have English as their sole first language. So they're also practicing simply expressing themselves. And that's cool. Terrific.
Oh, yeah. It definitely is. I mean, nothing gets people talking like, you know, sitting around in a role-playing game group, unless they're actively wallflowering. So
yeah.
Basically, nothing gets people talking like getting people talking.
And it's allowing them to really talk about what they're doing and why. To think about it ahead of time. And sometimes, in a role-playing situation, the game master says, "So, what do you do?" And some person says they're going to do something, you know, stupid. And everybody just says, "No, don't do that." And then they stop and think.
Yeah, that is a quintessential gaming scene. Somebody comes up with a harebrained idea, starts to do it, and everybody else at the table, like, dives out of their chairs and covers his mouth.
Yeah. See, I've seen that many times before, except for without the player then stops and thinks, and instead, you know, doesn't grab dice and goes, "Well, I'm going to attack it with my axe anyway."
Yeah, I've had dice actively stolen from me so I couldn't roll them.
There was an incident, in fact, we had somebody in one of our, all church people, but at somebody's house, gaming groups, and he had a loaded die, which he relied on, and we made him break it as part of the game.
Interesting. How'd that play? How did that happen? I'm curious.
Well, he'd been, you know, snickering about his magic dice for some time, and we were getting really sick of it. So we were having a New Year's party game, and I, as the party, as the adventure party approached the beginning place for their quest, they were supposed to be, they were on a quest sent by the king to steal everything they could out of a certain person's house, because the person had been stealing from everybody, and so the king wanted it back. So a hermit approached the wagon and stopped them, and the party looked out and said, "What?" And the hermit said, "You were approaching the Rock of Repentance. If any person sacrifices an evil object on the Rock of Repentance, they will receive a special blessing." And everybody in the room turned and looked at this one player.
Nice.
And then I took out a nice sizey chunk of rose quartz and a hammer and a pair of pliers and a candle and one of those little screw things so that you could turn it into a charm. So, okay, here it is, man. You can break it in bits or you can turn it into a pendant, but you know what's going to happen now. And after a sort of a token resistance, he decided that actually breaking it into bits would be more soul satisfying. So he took the hammer and broke it to bits, and we all cheered. And nice. Then I gave him a bonus. And one of the other characters in the party also said, "Well, you know, I've got these throwing knives. I'm a rogue, and this really is more of a naughty person's weapon rather than a good, honest weapon. So I'm going to break those two." And then he too got a special blessing and +2 for the encounter and something like that. But so that's how that played out. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds it.
Wow, that's actually really cool. That's
one of
the best incidents of metagaming I have ever heard of. somebody actually taking like a cheating device, destroying it in the real world, and then having that carry back into the game.
Yeah, I mean, normally for metagame bonuses, I just have to bribe my GM.
We had to do something physical for this person just to make it fun for him, to make it okay, so that we weren't having to come the heavy and sit on him and wrestle it out of his hands. That wouldn't have been any fun. That would have turned things sour. So that worked good. That stimulated good works, and it made things nice.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to do it. I've never had a problem with somebody bringing like loaded dice or anything crazy like that.
I am totally putting the Stone of Repentance outside of Terran's Reprieve, though. That is such a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good.
It's nice.
All right, so, Shannon, one of the other things that I thought was interesting is you've mentioned that the steampunk game centers around an aid society?
The West Peachum Mission Aid Society in the small village of West Peachum near Victoria, British Columbia in the year 1911.
Okay, so how does that play out? What kinds of stuff do your player characters do?
The first adventure, I always call them adventures rather than games for some reason. I don't know why, it just, the title worked. So the first adventure started with them realizing that they really hadn't heard anything from the uncle of one of the party members who had a missions and school down in South America. And they really hadn't heard from Uncle Josiah for an awfully long time. And then the inventor of the party handed him a note saying, remember, you've just completed your new airship. And so he said, well, I've got my new airship. We could go and take him some stuff and check him out, see if he's okay. And the Great White Hunter member of the party said, oh, good, there's things to shoot there, isn't there? Yes, let's do that. And so they all loaded all their equipment into the airship and headed off for South America to find Uncle Josiah. But it was just loaded up with things that he might need for his school, textbooks and medical supplies and all that stuff, and head off. And of course, as soon as they land, I get them into some sort of a Arthur Conan Doyle Lost World scenario where they have pterodactyls and lizard men and all and fun stuff like that.
That sounds pretty neat. I don't think...
And you're doing this with third edition D&D?
No, yeah. At the time I was trying to run it with the Rhesus or Rhesus system.
Okay, yeah.
Which was a good introduction to role-playing, I think, for especially for the younger members. We had a very mixed age group for that party, that initial party. The one kid was 9, 8, 8, I guess. And the oldest member was what, 60? Something like that? Older than me anyway. So we had quite a wide age range in the players. But Rhesus worked quite well. The only thing is, this is why I always revert to Dungeons & Dragons, because they've got it written out what the stats for the animals are. And it's the system that has the most charts. Whatever you say about it, and yes, somebody does, it's got charts. All you have to do is find the chart you want, and then adjust it to suit your tastes.
That is one of the nice things about D&D having been such a big budget production for so long, is the amount of reference material that's available for it is staggering. You get some of that with GURPS too, but GURPS is not quite as newbie-friendly as D&D is, and its combat gets really lethal, so...
Yeah, that's what I hear, is GURPS is very much a very gritty system in some ways. You take any damage, and it gets scary.
Well, and that's, you know, that's without even using, like, the optional rules for things like infection and bleeding and that sort of thing. I mean, it can get as bad as the real world if you're stacking everything on there. Of course, then, you know, opening a door in GURPS can take 6.5 hours of gameplay if you're using every optional rule, so...
I've heard it said that GURPS is a system for people who like playing with systems rather than like playing the game.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And this is as somebody who's done a little bit of writing for GURPS. It's a lot of fun to sit there and hack with the rules and make things and stuff like that. It's not so good in actual play. I think that's a very fair assessment, actually.
Fair enough. I've not actually tried GURPS, which is a pity, because I own a couple of GURPS books, so...
They are amongst the best reference volumes in the whole role-playing industry. Especially the third edition ones, the people would research those exhaustively. So I actually have used GURPS books as a jumping-off point for school papers before.
Nice.
I'm almost certain I've played GURPS, but it was, I don't know, 1987? It's been a while.
Oh, would that have been GURPS 2nd edition?
I don't know. Somebody else had the books. I just rolled the dice that Mongo told me to roll.
Gotcha.
I had a question for you, Shannon. The West Peachum Aid Society that you've got as your kind of in-character organization for your players.
Yes.
I'm curious about the Aid Society part of that. Is this a structure that you created for this game? Is it something that came up sort of naturally from gameplay, very organic sort of organization? Or how did that... Here's what I'm really asking, I suppose. How much structure do you give your players in a game like this where, you know, they're mostly kids? It's a church activity, so you, I suppose, have people coming in and out somewhat. How much do you do with that? You know, and obviously, you know, you want to exercise a little bit of control over the structure of the game and what they're doing so it doesn't run way off the rails into territory you and other church members aren't comfortable with. How do you set that up?
The reason I chose the West Peachum Mission Aid Society is because that's the sort of name where, for an activity like this, you can make a pretty banner and you can have the great big banner saying what the game is and put it on the table, and the kids will, or the players will gravitate to it, and anybody who looks at it will say, oh, West Peachum Mission Aid Society, that sounds safe. That's not going to bother anybody.
Okay.
And then, as far as structure goes, all I've done is that, so far, I've been the one who's made up the characters. It's faster that way. So I make up the characters and hand them the character sheet. And some so-and-so will be, you're the nephew of the president. You're the past president. You're a hanger-on. You're the reporter for the local paper, and so forth. But there is no real structure using the Mission Aid Society other than that's why... That's their only reason for such a disparate group of people meeting together. That they, too, met in the church basement.
Oh, okay. That's kind of a cool little parallelism.
And that's all there is to it. I have never worked out any of the details of the society. I think it would make the great basis for us for a series of books detailing their amusing adventures, if I ever felt like, you know, trying to write them up and could remember any of the details, except that would, you know, set the characters in canon, and I don't want to do that just yet. So I'm getting all the fun I can out of it before I sit down and do the writing. And basically, it's just an excuse for them to be, you know, going and butting their heads into everybody else's business in schools and missions across the world, anywhere where I think a story might be interesting.
Okay, so it's not even, it sounds like, an ongoing campaign. It's just, here's an adventure, here's an adventure, here's an adventure. And it's all episodic and really pretty disassociated from each previous adventure.
Yes, they sort of drift into each other. So the one that started out going to South America, then they had to work their way back.
Mm-hmm.
I found some interesting maps, and so they got lost for a while in South America and found something else. And then there were some interesting badlands in the western states on the way back. So they had several adventures on the way back, but But every time I refer it to, you know, the next adventure, so they had the Badlands adventure where they had, you know, cowboys and Indians and gunfire and stuff like that, and someone hijacked the ship and everything. And now they're off in Africa.
Okay.
Dealing with river bandits.
Now, are these adventures self-contained in a single session, or do you spread these out over like a month or something, or...
I wish that we could pay attention long enough for them to be self-contained in one evening. So far, that hasn't really happened. The pyramid one, we did manage to contain that within one evening. Generally, they're very short campaigns, though. 3 evenings should really wrap it up.
And how many hours do you play per session?
About 2 or 3 hours. When we have the games at our house, because there's so many things happening in the church and in the town these days that scheduling regular game nights over the fall hasn't been possible, then we'll run 3 hours or so. But I tend to think of them as about a 2-hour session.
So these are really tightly contained adventures, then.
Yes, they're very limited, of limited scope. A better game master than I could probably make any one of the particular adventures easily wrapped up in the length of a convention game slot. The kids get interested in role-playing the things that you would think they would just ignore.
Like what, for instance?
The running of the airship. They would be quite glad to role play a minute by minute wind speed calculations from here to South America in real time. They will just obsess over the tiny details like that. Which is good.
Yeah.
But I don't know enough about airships.
I don't know that that's any different from most gaming groups, honestly. I've been there.
I think maybe some of that is just an indication that they're really getting invested, because it seems like, at least for me, the more when I'm into something a lot in a game, I want to get a lot of detail because it helps put me more in the game mentally, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does show that this person has the right character. He's playing the right character for him, because so often he says, "And how does this work?" And I say, "I don't know. This is your airship. You invented it. You tell me and I'll believe you." And that works. The next stage, I'm in fact going to tell the inventors that, you know, I want them to draw such and such a device, and we are going to assume that whatever you draw works for our next adventure.
You know, I just realized something here. You're talking about drawing things. You're talking about bringing out little props at the table, you know, making someone actually break a loaded die at the table. When I was playing in your game at Fear the Con 5, which was a great game, by the way.
Thank you.
You had little tokens for each of us that we could, you know, that were a little magic, very minor magic item that we had in game, regardless of which character we picked. It seems like one of the things that you do a lot, and I'm curious to know whether this comes from gaming with kids who need this sort of thing, or if this is just something that you just like to do, regardless of who the gaming group is. You like to break that fourth wall a little bit and bring the player into the game with little props and actions and that sort of thing, as opposed to keeping it purely conceptual, making it the character is here and the player is here and never the twain shall meet.
I think it came from, in fact, the way I learned Dungeons and Dragons. Back in the ancient days, one person had a manual. The manual rarely actually came to the game. All the preparation was done ahead of time. And then we were just all there. So stuff was whatever we said it was. I just like playing with stuff, I think, really is what it works out to. I fidget a lot. I work better if I can play with something, and so I bring the toys to the table.
Does that help with a group that's mostly kids, though?
I think it does. It gives them something to fidget with. Kids especially, but many people of any age just plain think better when they can, when their fingers are working. So having a thing in your hand to focus on, it's something to touch. It's just fun.
Okay.
I try not to LARP, but I do wave my hands a lot.
I chuckle because the whole time we've been podcasting, I've been sitting here playing with my multi-tool, so I completely understand.
No, I fidget a ton. It takes an act of will for me to not sit here and spin my pencil around noisily on my fingers or crazy stuff like that.
All right, Shannon, in Writer's Guild, you kind of introduced us to this fantasy setting called Lake Turdian that you've created.
Yes.
I would love for you to talk about that a little bit, because I think this was one of the most... It was one of the least dark and most interesting fantasy settings I have seen in a long time. And I don't know, I would love to hear some of the thought process that you went through making it. If you could describe it to our listeners who weren't in the Writers Guild, that would be fantastic too. We all kind of really, Brandon, Grant, and I all kind of latched onto that, and that was one of the first things that got us thinking about having you on. So I think we would be remiss if we finish this episode without you at least getting a little bit of a chance to talk about that.
Lake Turdian is an outgrowth of my habit since I was, I don't know, 3, of telling myself stories when it was time to go to bed and I wasn't ready to fall asleep yet. So I would lay awake telling myself stories. And over time, especially around the time I was in high school, it began to take really very definite form. I know the shape and the region and some of the mythology and the history of this continent. It has shifted a little bit, but it's more and more taken specific shape and character. It's a place where I would be happy to play. It's a condensation of all the best places that I've been in North America. All those moments, you know, sometimes when especially very fluffy artists talk about, and poets talk about, coming out into the garden and it's just like a fairyland and you expect to see elves in the bottom of the garden. Well, you know, this is just all those magic moments condensed into a place where we can play. So Lake Turdian is just the condensed best place to play in with all the fun that we want. All the fantasy elements, all the bright, shiny, fun times, all the swashbuckling, but without some of the darker elements that I don't see the point in and just slow up the game and aren't fun anyway. So there is no necromancy in the world of Lake Turdian. It's a monotheistic system. On the other hand, if anybody has any preferred deities that they insist their cleric needs, they can be called a local hero or saint. It works all just the same as far as I'm concerned anyway. The one time at Fear the Con when I announced that, I expected someone to say, okay, sure, yeah, I can call my god a saint. Sure, yeah, that's no trouble. But there was just this sort of pause and then, Saint Patrick! My saint is Saint Patrick! Okay, and the game carried on.
Yep.
It was fun. It was good. We had just
was that Fear the Con 5?
That was Fear the Con 5. 4. That was Fear the Con 4.
Okay, that's why
we just had St. Patrick's Day. Because we just had St. Patrick's Day the day before and stuff like that.
Did the player character spend a lot of time chasing snakes around?
Yeah. There are 3 main species or races in the Lake Turdian world: elves, dwarves, and the younger races. There are lizard folk. There's many, many other kinds of. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, if you can find it in a monster manual and bring it in, except for demons and devils, sure, yeah, whatever. It doesn't bother me. It's just a map where we. For us to have fun in. On the other hand, I do have many, many stories that I've told myself, and now many game stories and places and legends associated with the places. Oh, I could just babble about it for hours because it's such a fun place to me, but the important thing is that it's a bright and comfortable place to play games in. When I thought of it always, I automatically start thinking, okay, what do people actually do here? So I know the economy a little bit. I'm an amateur geologist, so I naturally think about the rocks and the shape of the land. What else do you want to know about it?
What kind of conflict do you introduce to there? Because I know a lot of the time when people are running fantasy, and I have been guilty of falling back on this myself, they'll immediately tap some kind of horrible, world-shattering, mustache-twirling evil. And it sounds like you've managed to successfully avoid that for the most part. So yeah. What kind of stories do you like to tell with that particular setting?
Oh, well, petty villains are so much fun, too. There's the naughty Baron de Viche, who is the one whom the king commissioned the group to. This is the Loot the Mansion story, where the king has contacted the group of adventurers and said, look, we've got this bad Baron de Viche. He's off in the corner of the countryside. He's practically a law to himself. He's been stealing things all the time. He claims to be a pauper, and yet he throws these lavish parties that I should be so lucky to be able to afford. So go in there, see how much stuff you can steal from his house. And then what's your reward? Oh, the satisfaction of doing good and 10%. And so then the adventure party is supposed to go to this guy's New Year's party and see how much stuff you can steal from his house. Fear the Con 4, they managed to steal everything down to the snow shovels. 5, it was down to prying the candle holders off of the walls. Took the doormat, hired away his cook, took his golem butler, basically the works. So that's one standard thing.
Okay, so if I ever play in this scenario, my goal is going to be to go in and actually disassemble his house to boards and cart it back to the king.
Yeah,
don't want to disassemble his house, just put it on wheels and move it.
That would be good. That would be excellent. For your for reference, it is a Parker Brothers mansion. I use the Clue board.
That's a fantastic idea.
It's
funny.
Amazing.
I was just thinking today, the Clue board would be a really fun battle map. Yes, it's already gridded.
It is. It's excellent. It's very good. We assume that either the bedrooms are all upstairs or... Well, the bedrooms are upstairs, or sometimes some of the rooms, we reassign what the rooms are. Some of them are guest bedrooms instead of, why does he need both a library and a study, I ask. Stuff like that. But basically, I use the shape of the Clue board as the house. There's another game that I've run where there's a wizard who's whacked out by misusing the library in a monastery. That also is on a Parker Brothers mansion. It is now Gann's Inn because the... no, that's a third one. I guess I've used that board quite a lot. The Parker Brothers were very popular contractors. They did quite a lot of building in the area.
It's all tract housing, though. It's all the same.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the whacked out wizard is a fun one. Basically... a wizard sneaked into the monastery library and tried to memorize spells, both cleric spells and druid spells, and he was neither a cleric, so he's trying to triple class, and he didn't perform any necessary devotions, and so, you know, he flipped out. So the whole monastery is now littered wherever he went with spells gone wrong and minor half-made monsters and summonings and stuff like that. So the task of the adventurers is to go through, clean up the mess and find the whacked out wizard, suppress him and bring him back where he can get decent therapy.
He's going to be on somebody's couch for a long time after that.
Oh yeah. He's basically, he probably explodes in the end. I can't remember. There's one time where Baron Davish has stolen the king's wife or hidden her and has made a simulacrum of her and is trying to overthrow the kingdom. So the simulacrum and the wife have to be rescued and returned to the king. The Queen of Elfland's daughter, there is an elopement and under false pretenses. So the player, this was one that I did for Can Games. We ran it for the children, and then we later ran it for the adults. So some of the people got to run through the same game that their kids played, which was really fun. A young man with the king's guard had told the elvish princess that he was the prince of such and so, of Grisenden, and he convinced her to run away with him. He is not the prince of Grisenden. Grisenden is a dwarvish stronghold. He certainly does not have any title to it. He's just a lowly guard. So the player characters, to avert a scandal and to prevent the Three Kingdoms treaty to be signed, have this midnight ride through the forest to track down the erring couple, inform the princess that she does not really want to plight this troth, she doesn't, and to get everybody back home before anybody else can find out and avert the scandal. That was lots of fun. Yeah, very few major world-shattering events. World-shattering events have happened to this world, but not in the vicinity of Lake Tordion. I know what they are for world development purposes, I just think that, you know, war and battle is not fun for me, so I don't bother with it. If somebody else wanted to run a, you know, dark, heavy, serious thing using Lake Tordion, that's their lookout, but it's not my thing. But I wouldn't object if somebody, you know, took the Lake Tordion setting. I hope someday to get it published, and then if I found out that somebody was doing heavy, serious things, well, you know, that's why they bought a copy.
Honestly, I love the Lake Tordion setting, I was actually thinking, like, oh my gosh, where can I put it into my world that I'm building of this whole entire area and, you know, switch things around. So yeah, I might just take you up on that at one point.
You've got lots of continents. World's a big place.
It is, especially since I'm using the actual world.
Yeah, lots and lots of space.
So, where do you come up with your ideas for these types of kind of lower intensity conflicts that still create a lot of good role-playing opportunities, Shannon?
Believe it or not, this is me trying hard to think of dangerous situations where I can ever manage. I have people talk about managing a TPK, a total party kill. I never have any kills. I barely manage any casualties. This is me trying hard to be tough. I'm just not very good at it.
Well, like, I think the problem with the TPK is that I don't think you're putting them in dangerous situations, which I think is great. There was a DM that I used to run under who was obsessed with, like, Cthulhu-ish horror, and I absolutely, like, his stories were awesome, but I'm like, I don't want to play this game. I don't want to have to stare down Cthulhu. No.
Okay, here's one dangerous situation that I would love to see run in Lake Tordion, but I'm not a good enough game master to pull it off. The kings are currently trying in negotiation with the intelligent dragons, trying to get them to sign the treaties. However, you've got to figure out which dragons, A, are sentient, and B, are lawful enough, whether good or evil, to want to do this. So anyway, some group of adventurers has to go and try and negotiate with the dragons. That's a dangerous enough situation.
Yeah.
So you have both a kind of mindless beast and the standard D&D intelligent magical powerhouse varieties of dragon in your setting?
Yes, and the interesting thing about dragons in this setting is that there is no particular... dragons are a continuum. They range from the fairly small to the quite enormous, and from the mindless beast, you know, basically rattlesnake with or without legs, up to the great big Imperial Chinese dragon that is definitely smarter than you. And it's just, it's a continuum. In our world, we have dogs ranging from the, you know, the stupid little Chihuahua up to the enormous Great Dane. Well, in this world, dragons have that entire range plus a range of intelligence.
Well, you get that with dogs somewhat, too. You get you get like a Springer Spaniel that'll run into walls, and then you get my parents' old dog, who is a Border Collie Belgian Sheepdog mix, who I swear could understand normal English. He couldn't speak it, but he could definitely understand it.
Yeah, so you have that with the dragons. So, also in the Lake Tourdillon world, the color of a dragon does not tell you its moral outlook.
They are not color-coded for your convenience.
Darn it, that's always so simpler when I can go up and go, oh, that's black, I want to leave.
That must be rough on colorblind adventurers, I always thought.
Oh, not really. I think most of them are just going to be, let's avoid every dragon. I mean, even the metallic ones could be very, very, like, painful if you crossed them.
Well, now I'm picturing, like, three colorblind adventurers, all with different forms of colorblindness, trying to determine what color the dragon is before it notices them.
What do you mean before? The dragon's already noticed them and is just watching, going, really, this is the best entertainment ever. I get dinner and a show.
Yeah, I've never, of all the things that I find annoying about Dungeons and Dragons, the way they treat dragons is fairly high up on my list. Other things I can ignore, but the way they treat dragons just is so far at variance from historical fiction and, I want to say reality, but of course we're talking fantasy things, but so far removed from heraldic practice and from literature, both classic and folklore, and so I simply adjust everything until it lines better up with fiction, well, established fiction and classical literature and heraldry.
That's not all that surprising, considering some of your other tastes. You seem to like kind of a mythic or fairy tale like structure to things from what you've been describing here. So that fits the kind of modern D&D style. I'm a dragon. I can talk. I can cast spells. I can do all this other crazy stuff. Really does feel just kind of like somebody tried to make the most impressive monster they could. So I can definitely see a preference away from that. That's bugged me to various lesser extents at varying times in my gaming career.
And it's easy to fix. You just check the charts and then adjust them to what you think your current dragon ought to be, and there you are.
There you go.
So it sounds like you've gotten at least a little bit of traction using this setting in some of your church groups too. How has that worked out?
Well, not in the church groups, but most of the gamers I've played with in Deep River have, in fact, been from our church or from some of the other churches around. We haven't actually played any Lake Tourdillon at the church games nights, but family games nights with various other members of the church. The longest running gaming group we had was with another family from St. Barnabas, who have since unfortunately moved to New Zealand. It's too far to go and play games with them now, so.
Yeah, and unfortunately even a Skype game would be hard, you know, across that many time zones. So.
Alas.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, but it was very good, and it was really a very formative influence on Lake Tourdillon because we were playing for a long time.
Nothing really develops a setting like playing in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was good. My time in the Society for Creative Anachronism also was a major influence, both because I am of my familiarity with armor and how armor actually works, and because of the heraldic connection. And just there are so many lovely heraldic monsters that don't show up in the monster manual that are just so much fun. And medieval literature is just chock full of beasts that just have don't show up in the standard monster manuals, and they all show up in Lake Tourdillon.
Can you give me an example?
The Yale. The Yale looks like an antelope, except that it's got two great big long tall horns, which it is able to swivel and turn, so that it has attack horns, so you think, oh, well, I can approach the Yale from this side, but then it swivels its horns to poke you from that side, too.
Huh. Interesting.
How did that not make it into a monster manual? That is very D&D.
Yes, isn't it wonderful?
I think the phrase antelope kind of cut it out.
Heraldic antelopes have saw-edged horns and a spike on the nose, and the way they look, I think they eat meat, so a heraldic antelope is a little bit more of a creature than the real world antelope. Let's see. Yourself.
Go digging around in old heraldry books.
Oh, yeah, the Opinicus. It started out as a cat and a goat and several other things. Oh, yeah, check the heraldic resources. Bruce Dracunarius's Picture Dictionary of Heraldry is a superb resource.
I'll have to link that in the show notes, then.
Yes, I think it still exists.
Well, if not, we can probably find it.
Yeah, but any good heraldry manual is well worth looking through for strange and interesting creatures. The beaver looks very different. The sea dog, just there's scores of them, and they're... Even the ones that are in the monster manual, many of them look differently. So you have the heraldic version of something, and they're generally different, and definitely they look scarier.
Huh.
Because the whole point of putting something on your shield is to say, I'm big and tough, bigger and tougher than you, so back off.
Right. Huh.
I'm just wondering how, through 30 years of D&D, more of this stuff didn't eventually get incorporated. Because it seems like such an obvious place to pull... My mind is blown. I didn't know that there was all of this out there.
What I would really love Wizards of the Coast or the D&D people to do would be to make they keep making, supplementary monster manuals?
Yeah, they made it up to 5 with 3rd edition.
Yeah, well, what they need is another one where they in fact, do... classic monsters and specifically actually look at heraldic and mythological sources, look at what Herodotus and those guys really did say about things, and then say, okay, this is for placing your games in ancient Cimmeria or ancient Greece, so this is a little bit different.
See, that's the sort of thing that I would think you'd find in something like Dungeon or Dragon magazine, and I think Wizards of the Coast is still taking submissions for 4th edition.
Oh, yeah.
For D&D Insider.
Mm-hmm.
I know, and, they pay for it, so...
Oh, yeah, so it'd be worth going through the old texts and brushing stuff up and writing stuff down.
Yeah, you'd have to stat up all the monsters and give a little information about them. I have no idea what they're doing for D&D next, as far as that goes.
This also strikes me as the sort of thing that the Paizo guys would be all over, too.
But because the framework for the stats is already there, it's just a matter of filling in the details.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a good project.
Yeah. Earn somebody some money.
Get some fun stuff out there. Because really, having an adventure in the world as imagined by Herodotus would be hilariously good. I mean, there's some very strange creatures. There's
yes.
very odd people. The whole geography is totally different. It would be really a fun game to play.
It would. Have you ever heard of a game called Aegon, A-G-O-N?
No.
It's role-playing in mythic Greece.
Ah.
That's the sort of thing that, Herodotus's monsters and that sort of thing would be really appropriate for, because, they're... It's Greek, traditional Greek mythology and legend, but even then, these distant lands, you have, your group of heroic adventurers going to these faraway places and meeting these very strange things that Herodotus and other contemporary authors are writing about. That might be a good fit for that game as well. I've not played Aegon, but I've read a bit of it, and it seems like the sort of thing that could fit.
That would be worth looking up.
Yeah.
I've got that on my list.
I just provided you a link to the site, actually. I quietly Google things and then paste links into the Skype bar. It'll also be linked in the show notes, folks.
Speaking of systems, I had a thought just a little bit ago about your steampunk game for your group at church.
Mm-hmm.
Spirit of the Century.
Ah, right.
I own it. I love the game. It's got a few problems here and there, but the game is just, it's a lot of fun. And I think for the format you're doing, it's particularly good. Spirit of the Century doesn't even have any character advancement mechanics. It's all about just, here are characters, let's go have fun with it in these short little episodic stories.
That's
also is set up in such a way where the characters are kind of intrinsically intertwined with each other from the outset. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Now this brings up a question. In your church group, which again you said was mostly kids, how many people come and go from that?
Oh, yeah. When we're actually having the games nights at the church, we have a core. There's about three or four who will always drop everything else to come and play the game.
Okay.
And then there is a roving band of some six or eight more.
Oof.
I try really hard not to have more than six players at a time, but sometimes it doesn't work out that way.
Yeah, I've tried to run for a large group before. Yeah. I still remember the migraines.
Oh, all I have to do is remember, always have spare character sheets ready, because you never know when somebody's, you've already handed out the character sheets and then you're getting started, and then somebody comes who was there, you know, 3 weeks ago, and so you just want to be able to hand out another character. And these kids are extremely adaptable that way. The one young man, really, he wants to play the inventor. But most of the others, by and large, you know, they show up late. Oh, yeah, so who am I today? Okay, sure, yeah. So my name's Aretha, is it? Okay, I can deal with that. And they just carry on. So just always to have some spare character sheets, have good character sheets written up for all the NPCs, because they might suddenly become player characters. It's okay. And they'll draft their friends who are walking by on their way to a different game.
Interesting. I'm curious. I know we're sort of talking about this, or at least we theoretically started off talking about this as, you know, using games to sort of teach some moral lessons and just have fun and fellowship and that sort of thing. Has the hobby kind of gotten into these kids' lives at all? Is it, you know, hey, do the kids want to go home and start up their own RPGs that you know of? Or is it just something they do at church?
I think they mostly do it with me, mm-hmm. but I'm thinking that there are some of them whom I'm going to have to be introducing the idea of them taking it on for themselves. I've given them all copies of the Rhesus print, the printout of the Rhesus game system.
Right.
Because several of them, I think, have both the drive to do it on their own and probably the ability to do it on their own with their friends. Mostly, okay. they just do it when I'm going to be doing it. I think partly that's because of their age, but they're getting to be the age and the ability that sooner or later they're going to be wanting to take off and do it themselves.
How many real-world issues and concerns and problems do you bring into the game? Is it something where it's, you know, I give you a moral problem, however lighthearted, and kids solve it? Is it that sort of teaching? Or is it, here's an adventure, let's just go have fun? And I'm asking because on the Fear of the Boot forums, there's someone, and we mentioned this briefly last episode as well, someone doing role-playing as a form of therapy with some very emotionally damaged kids. Obviously, it's not that intense or that necessary for what you're doing, but I'm curious if there's any element of that.
There's a little bit of that. Not very much. There is a certain amount of sort of drift over from current things that we're working on. a short while ago in Sunday school, there was a project where the kids, in fact, were raising money to be sent on a missions project to help other children in, I guess, migrant workers in Haiti after the earthquake and displaced people. So they were raising money, and I think I was able to mention it to them that, yeah, here you're doing what the Peacham Aid, West Peacham Mission Aid Society did. You're sending material to help a mission down there. And, yeah, that's neat. We are doing that, aren't we? Yeah, we can do this. And so just the thought, we can participate. We can be part of something bigger. But there isn't, by and large, we're in it for the fun. If we learn something, that's convenient and good for us, but we aren't trying hard to learn anything, either intellectually or spiritually. We always want to, in general, be learning, but the point of the game is to have fun. And we try to learn from each other because we want to learn from each other anyway, because it's a fellowship, not just goofing off.
Right.
So as a follow-up question to that, could you see ever running a game specifically kind of as a moral sandbox, or do you think that would take all the fun out of it?
Oh, I can see somebody better at me than running games doing it, but I'm basically a bit of a hack-and-slash specialist. I put obstacles to be taken down. I give projects. I set up enemies, mostly non-sentient enemies, except, I put out the targets and let people do what they want. However, I can see somebody better than me at organizing that sort of game. I don't even know how to run bluff checks and that kind of stuff. The crunch is beyond me, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
I mean, I'm really a hack and slash type player, and I'm a bit of a hack and slash game master too.
There's certainly nothing wrong with that. I mean, and what you've described is a lot more than pure hack and slash too. I mean, the scenarios that you were talking about earlier are quite a bit more interesting than, oh, look, orcs, you know, give me an initiative roll.
Yeah, the Lake Turdeon game that we played, I'm not sure there was ever combat. Each creature that we were dealing with was more of a puzzle. Okay, we've got these tools. How do we get this creature into this bag? Which was fun, but it's not hack and slash. It's creative puzzle solving. So there's a lot to that.
And it is fun. But yeah, I don't mind combat. I do combative games when I'm in that sort of thing. I'm just not good at writing them very well. The puzzle thing, the messing around in a dungeon, that I'm better at.
Gotcha. Is there combat in the game that you do at the church?
Oh, they just had a really great bit of combat in the last game that we played. I roll dice very badly. I can't roll a killing dice. I just can't. I figured, okay, we've got three people, my husband and the two guys who were playing. We had expected a larger turnout. I figured, okay, right, there's the three of them. Surely if I make six bandits trying to overpower them, surely they'll be able to, the bandits will be able to overpower them. No, I just kept rolling sixes and twos and ones. Oh, it just worked like that. I don't know, I'm just going to have to blow up the boat if I want them to get away from the boat.
There you go. Yep, somebody mind the river. Doop-de-doop.
Yeah, it's or a hippopotamus can eat it, I don't know. But if
there you go. Yeah, a hippopotamus is a natural 20, I'm just saying.
Yeah,
it must be.
Save versus hippo.
There is no save. No. You're talking about combat. Obviously, you know, these are bandits, they're human, sentient enemies. The two problems that people brought up when you were originally talking about this, were magic and dragons. Is violence something that people are worried about, you know, at the church, when you're doing games like this? Is killing people in combat something that comes up, or is it always, you know, a nice knockout blow, you know, with the flat of the sword, and then you tie him up and take him off to the sheriff's office? Is it kind of that G-rated sort of violence, or does it go any further than that? And do people have a problem with that?
So far, it's mostly been fairly G-rated. Knock them out and tie them up so we can sit on them and ask them searching questions, like where they put the things that we think they stole. Okay. It's mostly been the knock them down and try to tie them up and deliver them to the authorities. Mm-hmm. I haven't pushed for much more than that.
Sure.
Yeah, why would you? If the players have good habits, you don't want them to unlearn them.
Yeah, exactly. And giving them the opportunity to simply tie up the bandits and possibly put them to washing dishes and doing useful work would be certainly far more interesting as a game development too, because then they've got these characters and they have to keep an eye on.
Right.
So it would be more fun anyway.
Good. Okay. Just curious about that, because I know violence is actually one of the biggest concerns I hear about with RPGs.
Yeah, and that is a concern. You don't want to just, you know, let's go to church and wage mayhem. Mm-hmm. No, we don't want to be doing that.
I can see how you would definitely want to avoid any over-the-top violence and keep it, you know, no worse than certainly, you know, your standard Saturday morning cartoon violence. You know, a bonk on the head and a convenient, oh, I woke up tied up to this chair.
Yeah, and so long as you litter the landscape with plenty of jaguars and pythons and pteranodons and things, you know, legitimate targets,
sure.
That lets them blow away lots of things that it's all right to blow away, and have lots of good dice rolling fun. And
right.
Really, I think they got just as much fun from getting thoroughly beaten up before one of them managed to finally escape than they would have with, you know, three clean blows and the whole thing's over. It was so much more fun getting nearly beat up and getting tied up and having to be rescued by the remaining member of the party. That was more fun. Yeah, they have a semi-tame chimpanzee along with them too, who acts as an NPC. I have plans for that chimpanzee.
Nice.
Complicating their life too. But
I will tell you for a fact, and unfortunately I know this from direct family experience, having monkeys of any sort in the house is not fun.
No, they've got all the cleverness of a 2-year-old and far less discretion.
Yeah. My grandfather at some point thought it was a bright idea to buy a pair of lemurs and bring them into the house.
Oh
dear.
Yeah.
Oh.
Did he also think it was a good idea to bring in squirrels? Because I would imagine the effect would be similar.
No, because, see, squirrels don't scream all night.
Oh, gotcha.
You would be surprised. I have actually heard a squirrel make a noise. I thought they didn't make any, but I followed one and it made noise.
Oh, yeah, squirrels make noise all the time. They don't, however, hang on the ceiling fan and scream at you. Or... Well, okay, they do hide in closets and leap out at you, but lemurs do that too, and they're bigger.
Yeah, lemurs, they're nocturnal, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, with the great big, creepy, glowing eyes. It's a fun family story, let me tell you. Oh, man.
And you said there were two of these things.
Yes. Look, my grandfather owned a pier down in Florida. He just went down and was like, oh, hey, lemurs, those look fun.
Just, Grant, remember this conversation for the colonization part of the upcoming campaign. That's
oh, yeah.
All I'm saying.
Yeah, and Shannon, I'm just telling you, if you want to scare your party in a harmless way,
mm-hmm.
have lemurs sneak onto the boat.
Oh, yeah.
Lemurs in the closet.
It's just things moving around at night, big green glowing eyes. What are they? Oh, it's lemurs.
That's... Good. I will remember lemurs.
Yeah.
Actually, Africa has a whole bunch of strange animals that we mostly don't think about, some of which I saw at the St. Louis Zoo, and some of which I just looked up mammals and creatures and reptiles of Africa and just went through the whole list and clicking on any names that I didn't recognize what the name was and looking at it. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of interesting stuff that's going to happen.
Good. You could probably do that with South America and Australia too.
Yes, but anything on Australia is poisonous and will kill you.
Yeah, so. That's true.
Yeah, that's what saving rolls are for.
Yeah, don't they even have poisonous sharks in Australia?
No, they just have sharks.
Yeah.
I think actually there is some kind of like a poisonous shark-like fish that's native to the coast of Australia.
Okay, well, they have poisonous fish.
Yeah.
But, you know.
They're not sharks. They just have a lot of poisonous fish that are terribly dangerous and venomous spiders that will chase you. And
dangerous jellyfish. And
yeah.
Yes.
There's a song that my sister found, which is basically these guys like naming every single one of like the common poisonous things in Australia and in a song, and the chorus is, "Come to Australia, you might accidentally get killed."
Nice. We'll have to find that. We'll have to see if it's on YouTube or something.
That's good.
Yeah. Shannon, anything you want to plug while you're here?
Well, I will say that if anybody is interested in doing the West Peachum games, I would be happy to give the preparation notes that I have for them. If anybody else wants to play with that, there's about a page of written material and stuff. So if anybody's curious about that, take the idea. I would be happy to give the material on that to anybody who's interested in it. I continue to write the Lake Tourdillon stuff. I am now actively looking for an artist, and I look forward to having that setting and games available for anybody else to play with.
Fun. Yeah, we'll work with you on getting the
fantastic.
The West Peachum stuff up in some format that people can look at, so that'll be fun.
Mm-hmm.
All right, folks. Well, I think we're about out of questions for Shannon.
Shannon, thank you so much for coming on with
us. Yes, thank you so much.
Having you.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for letting me do this.
Oh no, it's our pleasure.
Yeah.
You're fun to talk to.
Yeah, you're welcome to come back too. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, folks, I think that's going to do it for us. I do want to remind people real quick, our fundraiser for PEG Partners is still going on. Head out to our website, savingthegamepodcast.org, to get more info about that. There's a big 2012 holiday fundraiser link up at the top of our page. But on that note, everybody, have yourselves a good evening or good morning or wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and hopefully we'll catch you next time.
See ya.
See ya.
Good night, everybody.
This has been a production of Saving the Game, copyright 2012. This podcast may be redistributed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative license, provided that credit is given to savingthegamepodcast.org. Our music is by Ryan Humphrey. For past episodes, podcast news from our hosts, or to connect with us, visit our website at savingthegamepodcast.org. God bless, and happy gaming.